This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley. Ohio voters who have not cast early votes will head to the polls on Tuesday. Races for governor and senator are still drawing national figures to come into the state to try to tip the outcome one way or another. One statewide issue and congressional races, 10 judicial seats and a host of local ballot issues will impact policy for years to come. For a last big picture overview, we are joined today by Cincinnati Enquirer government reporter Jesse Ballmer and WVXU politics reporter Howard Wilkinson. If you have questions, especially if you haven't made up your mind in a race or on an issue, call 513-419-7100 or email us at talk@wvxu.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Jesse, Howard, welcome back to Cincinnati Edition, right here on the sort of eve of the election. Jesse, the Sixth Circuit Court down here in Cincinnati sort of threw a wild card into the mix yesterday with a ruling. Can you catch us up on that and what it might mean?
Yeah, so essentially this is about voters who are removed from the rolls because they hadn't voted in recent elections or done things like sign petitions or, you know, re-registered to vote. And there was a U.S. Supreme Court decision that said essentially this practice was okay, but we've had a couple court cases decide that it's okay for those people to vote. I would say it affects a very small number of Ohio's voters, and so I don't think it's going to have a huge impact on the election coming up. And I think that's one reason why John Husted, the current Secretary of State, who's also on the ballot as Lieutenant Governor with Mike DeWine, is not challenging it.
Yeah, he disagrees with it, but he's not going to challenge it at this point.
No, there's no point in challenging it at this point, 5 days out, or 4 days out now, I guess.
Yeah. So affects few people, even the people it might get back into the process. It's hard to know if they'll know who they are and whether they'll can be contacted and whether
political parties, particularly Democrats, would have to get the message out somehow to those people. And they're difficult to find in the first place because they don't vote.
Yeah. So, okay.
It's true. And there was a lot of attention on this issue when the U.S. Supreme Court decision came down. And a lot of those people ended up voting in the primary earlier this year or registered to vote for the race that's coming up in a few days. And so I think a lot of those people are probably taken care of.
That's right. Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's, Jesse, let's take a look at some of the races here. The one that I think most people think is still close, is in fact close, is the governor's race between Mike DeWine and Richard Cordray. What do the polls indicate that we're facing here on Tuesday?
The polls essentially indicate a toss-up. You can look at one that has maybe Cordray a little bit ahead. You can look at another that has Mike DeWine a little bit ahead. And so I think it's hard to discern too much from the polls. Neither of them says what candidate is going to run away with this race. And I think that is what makes it so interesting. It's been a little bit since Ohio has had a really competitive governor's race that has come down to the wire like this. And so it'll be interesting. I think it's worth noting that, like, in a regular year, Mike DeWine's name recognition and just general knowledge around the state, people know who he is, probably put him at quite the advantage. But this is a year where 2 years after the presidential election is always a referendum on the president. And so Democrats feel good about being able to make up that gap.
Howard, when we're talking about a statewide race like this, is as close as it looks like.
Yes.
What does this might mean on Tuesday?
What it means is that Wednesday morning, we may not know who the next governor is going to be. If it is razor thin, even something like 50,000 to 80,000 votes, you've got all of those.
So razor thin is 50,000 to 80,000.
You go back to, and Jesse referred to it, you go back to 1974, which was the first governor's race I covered, and Jack Gilligan from Cincinnati was the incumbent Democrat, and Jim Rhodes, the former governor, was challenging him. And Gilligan led for most of the night until late, and it began turning the other way. And in the end, he won by 11,000 votes. And that is less than one vote per precinct, because in those days there was about over 13,000 precincts in Ohio. It's amazing. But the thing about that race was, back then, you didn't have the provisional ballots to worry about. And now we'll have probably at least 150,000, if not more, you know, maybe possibly closer to 200,000 that can't be counted until 10 days after the election.
So there could be a 10-day period of—
where we have absolutely no idea.
with a lot of jockeying about which provisional votes—
right.
get counted and which
and both
don't.
Parties will be looking at those very carefully. Yep. And then even after that happens, you could end up with some kind of an automatic recount.
So I think it's fair to say that what we all know and we all talk about over and over again, it comes down to turnout and what the turnout is going to be and who can get their voters to the polls on Tuesday or before. In the early vote. And in fact, we have a caller. John has called in and I think has a question or an observation that relates to this question of who's going to turn out. John, thanks for calling. What's your observation?
Hello. Yes, I'm an undecided voter. I'll probably not vote, and I can make a good case for other people not voting too. But in the spirit of Abraham Lincoln, the Party of Republicans, and John Kennedy, the Party of the Democrats, two great people, here in Cincinnati, we have Atef Pure Evil and Steve Chabot, both being investigated, as the commercials say, for, committing fraud, I guess. You know, $107,000 for the website, and then Pure Evil's doing, as they say every day, all the stuff he's doing. If both these guys get locked up, what's going to happen?
Well, nobody's going to get locked up. Let's take that off the table.
And that's always been clear.
Right. That's been clear from day number one. And nobody is going to be locked up.
Yeah. And as long as this has been brought up, let's jump ahead to the decisions that were made at the Ohio Board of Elections, Elections Commission yesterday on the charges that were brought against the AFTAB PureVol campaign. Howard, what was the result of that?
Well, the result of it was that there were 29 separate accusations that were made by the people who filed this, which was the Coast organization, Citizens Opposed to Additional Spending and Taxes. And the Ohio Elections Commission found that only in one case of those 29 was there an apparent violation. And it had to do – now, the whole thing was dealing with about $30,000 of money that they say was coming from AFTAB Purval's state account for running for clerk of court and being used for a congressional campaign. You're not supposed to do that. That's not legal. And they found – the only thing they found, though, out of that $30,000 was a bill for – what was it, Jesse? $360 or something?
$360,
right.
Yeah.
For a photographer who went to his event where he announced his campaign and was shooting pictures for them.
Yeah.
And he was – apparently he was paid from – the clerk of court's account, which he shouldn't have been. He should have been paid for out of the federal campaign account.
And the punishment
for
that?
Okay, the big deal. $100.
$100.
Enough, I mean.
Right. So I don't want to get stuck on this one because this, there's a political side to this aside from the charges themselves, because mm-hmm. this has been out there all along during the campaign.
It's been out there all along, and as AFTAB Purval made the point last night in his press conference, he said that the Chabot organization has spent $3 million on television ads saying that he was going to go to jail over this, which is absolute total nonsense. Now, most of those ads were actually paid for not by Shabbat's campaign, but by Paul Ryan's super PAC.
Right.
But they use this one line, might go to jail, and ran with it. And in the end, it's a $100 fine, period.
Yeah.
That's not even a slap on the wrist. That's not even a pat on the cheek.
Let's get back to some of the statewide races and the statewide issues. Jesse, the governor's race is close enough that it's drawing in outside national figures who are trying to see if they can sway the race one way or the other. And it's been kind of interesting to see how many people have been coming into Ohio and trying to work this electorate.
Yeah, I've almost jokingly termed it surrogate week because it's been almost one a day. We've had kind of a national figure from either the left or the right coming in to campaign for Rich Cordray, the Democrat, and Mike DeWine, the Republican, in this race. So you have people like progressive Massachusetts lawmaker Elizabeth Warren, who campaigned in Columbus and then Athens, Ohio, where Ohio University is based, for Rich Cordray. Today you have John Kasich, the current sitting governor, is campaigning for Mike DeWine. And then, of course, President Donald Trump will be in Cleveland on Monday campaigning for DeWine and other Republicans. So I think it's just kind of reminding voters that, hey, this race is coming up. It's getting out the people that you think are going to, you know, hey, I really like Donald Trump, maybe I'll vote for DeWine. Or, hey, I really like John Kasich, maybe I'll vote for DeWine. Or, I really like Joe Biden, I'm going to vote for Rich Cordray. And it's not a bad approach. I know I've talked with voters who that's a compelling message for. And it's what you do one week out.
Well, I think the most interesting one, and tell me if you agree or disagree, Jesse, but is Kasich, who has been laying very low during this whole thing. And now he's suddenly doing a rally with Mike DeWine. And not only that, he's cut a 30-second TV commercial where he basically talks about all of his achievements over, you know, his term as governor and says, we have to continue all this and we need Mike DeWine to do it. So he has come out of hiding. And the ironic thing is that he just might be more popular a figure right now with some Democratic leaning voters or some independent voters in Ohio than he is with the Republican base.
Well, before we take a break, and we do have to take a break, let me just raise the question of the Senate race. How close is this, Jesse?
The U.S. Senate race?
Yes.
I guess I'd be surprised if it's very close. Nearly all the polls have shown the incumbent Democratic Senator Sherrod Brown with a pretty sizable margin on this race over Jim Renacci, the U.S. representative, who is a Republican in this race. Jim Renacci has not been spending very much of his own money that he put into the campaign. There hasn't been a lot of money spent on his behalf. And so it's certainly possible in a swing state for the Republican to make a decent showing. But I guess that would be the shocker of the night if Renacci pulled it out over Brown.
I think the National Republican Party wrote him off a long time ago, and that's why you didn't see the money flowing into Ohio for Jim Renacci.
Does Sherrod Brown have any coattails that help other people down the ticket?
It's possible, but, you know, usually the coattails come with a gubernatorial candidate, not a Senate candidate.
This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley. With Election Day on Tuesday, we have gathered several reporters who can answer your closing questions. Ohio Public, Cincinnati Inquirer government reporter Jesse Ballmert and WVXU politics reporter Howard Wilkinson. To join our conversation, you can call 513-419-7100 or email us at talk@wvxu.org. Before we get off the statewide thing, I want to, Jesse, in the other statewide races, attorney general, auditor, secretary of state, treasurer, how do you see are there any there that, you know, we should really be watching on Tuesday because you think they're going to be extremely close and may tell us something?
I think it'll be interesting. I think they'll certainly benefit from whatever is happening at the top of the ticket from, you know, DeWine or Cordray if they happen to, you know, get a decent margin going there on the race. But because I think that race is going to be so close and because there isn't a lot of attention to the U.S. Senate race, these ones could be even more interesting. I think, as always, the attorney general's race is usually like the next one up after the governor's race, just because there is a lot of responsibility with the top cop and the top lawyer of the state, and that is between Republican Dave Yost and Democrat Steve Dettelbach. Steve Dettelbach has really made this let's clean up Columbus kind of campaign for him, focusing on the lack of oversight in his mind from Dave Yost on the charter school electronic classroom of tomorrow, or ECOT. I think the Secretary of State's race is always interesting. Both Kathleen Clyde, the Democrat, and the Republican, Frank LaRose, were pretty involved in efforts to reform redistricting, the kind of drawing of the lines that has been so gerrymandered in the past. And so both of them were very engaged on that topic, and I think that'll be interesting to watch.
The thing that struck me so far about the down-ticket races is that, generally speaking, you know, we go through this every 4 years. The Republicans have dominated those races now, you know, through several election cycles. And they have in the past barely paid any attention whatsoever to their opponents. But now you're starting – this year is different. You're seeing Dave Yost with attack ads and mail pieces against Steve Dettelbach. Just before I came in here, I saw a TV ad from attacking Kathleen Clyde, the Democratic candidate for Secretary of State. I mean, you haven't seen those kind of that kind of rough and tumble stuff in the down ticket races in most years.
Which indicates they're close.
Which indicates they're probably close, or at least they believe the other side has an opportunity.
So turn out again.
Another thing that is in play with these particular races is control over this redistricting commission, which is going to draw the lines for the congressional races and is going to have a role in the races for the people that we're sending to Columbus for representatives. And that's the governor, auditor, and secretary of state would be on that with a number of lawmakers from each party. And I think especially national groups see this as an opportunity to get more control over the map for Democrats.
Okay. We've got a lot of calls, so let's take one. Dennison, you have a question about a statewide issue. Issue one.
I do, Dan. The question that I had was, because I've ping-ponged back and forth on this issue, hearing various people talk about it, and obviously it has to do with a drug issue and how to deal with low-level felony possession offenders. And my initial inclination was, let's try something else, because clearly what's going on isn't exactly working in the state of Ohio. But then I heard judges push back against it, saying if we don't actually have the authority to put these folks behind bars, they'll never go to rehab. But then the counter to that I've heard from supporters are saying, yes, they can always go to jail. And what question I have is, if we send the low-lying drug offenders to jail, what does that do to the population of the Hamilton County Justice Center and the local jails throughout the various communities? I've never heard that question answered, and I didn't know if you had an answer to that.
Howard or Jesse, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I think you actually have a pretty good grasp of the points and counterpoints that people are making about issue one. One thing is on the first and second offense for drug possession, which for fourth and fifth degree felonies would now be misdemeanors, you would not be sent to jail or anything like that. So it would take the third offense within 24 months in order to be sent to jail. So I think a number of those people would not immediately be a part of the Hamilton County jail population, but certainly I think it would lead to an increase there.
And let's not fool ourselves. The Hamilton County Justice Center is packed.
Right.
So, Howard, anything to add?
Almost always is. And it's not unique to Hamilton County either. I mean, it's the case in a lot of particularly larger counties in Ohio. But Hamilton County has had a real chronic problem of overcrowding. Right. We know that.
Dennison, I would suggest that you check our Cincinnati Edition show that was a couple of weeks ago on issue one. I thought it was an excellent interview. I'm not sure it deals just with this issue, but it would give you some people who you could call and ask that question if you want further information. Thanks for calling. Kathy, you have a question which is on a very local issue that we have not dealt with on this show, so I wanted to make sure you get it on. What is your question? Kathy?
Oh, sorry, I didn't hear my name. I wasn't sure if it was me. This is Kathy. Yes, my question is in regard to the Children's Services levy. I have already voted. I'm not going to be there Tuesday, but I hadn't seen much about the need for it. So as I read about the issue, and there's clearly a need, but there's a need more broadly across the state, and it seems like our state being 50th out of 50 in funding for Children's Services needs to step up, and I wasn't sure what the mechanism would be to kind of not just have our county bearing the burden, plus only keeping it in the county, but how do we make this a more broad state issue going forward? And that may be out of the scope of the program.
Well, the only way you do that is to elect a legislature that's willing to commit the money necessary to do that. And, you know, the Children's Services Levy is one of those levies, along with Elderly Services Levy, that most people support in this county. They have in the past, even if they, you know, as much as they hate taxes or proclaim to hate taxes, they will end up voting for those kind of services because someone they know or someone in their household is directly affected.
I do think there's an implication here. There is a discussion on the statewide races, particularly for governor, about whether the local government cuts that were imposed by the Kasich administration should be restored, that the state budget was balanced really on the back of local government. And in that sense, I think there is a way that this type of issue of the children's levy in this particular case is sort of at the root of some of the statewide issues. Jesse, you have any thoughts about that?
I agree. I think the money that was taken from the local government fund has come up quite a bit in this governor's race. I think both Cordray and DeWine have said that they would like to restore some of that money. I know Cordray has hit that a little bit harder. One of the challenges is, you know, the state has reduced income taxes and some other taxes off of that money and other tweaks in the budget. And so the question is, if we return that money, what else is cut or changed or raised to adjust that? And I think that'll be something for the next governor to find out. I also would say the state budget is figured out before June 30th of next year. And so that's a great time to talk to your lawmakers about concerns like this.
Well, I want to thank Jesse Wolmer and Howard Wilkinson, not only for today, but all of the times in the last couple of months we've been talking about getting ready for Election Day, which is Tuesday.
It is.
And the main thing is everybody should get out there and vote. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley. 10 days ago, on October the 24th, after being prevented from entering a predominantly African-American First Baptist church in suburban Louisville, a 51-year-old white man went to a nearby supermarket and allegedly shot two African-Americans. For some state legislators, that has raised the question of whether Kentucky should add the legal option of charging a hate crime in the case of certain homicides. To examine the incident and the aftermath, we are joined by Louisville Courier-Journal reporter Thomas Novelli. To join our conversation, please call 513-419-7100 or email us at talk@wvxu.org. Thomas, welcome to Cincinnati Edition.
Thank you so much for having me on the program.
Just to start out, especially since a lot of our listeners are not in your immediate area, sort of lay out what happened here.
Absolutely. There's no doubt about it. Last week was an incredibly violent week in America. I mean, we had, of course, all of the bombs that were sent around to different news organizations and senators. We had this past weekend what happened with the tragedy in Pittsburgh. And even Louisville, Kentucky didn't get out of that week unscathed. So what happened was there is a Kroger in the suburbs of Louisville, and a man, Gregory Allen Bush, who's been identified as the suspect in that crime, walked into this Kroger and shot one of the Kroger customers point blank in the aisle, seemingly at random, and then made his way out to the parking lot where he shot another African-American customer as well. What we're aware of at this point is it all happened very quick, but as we started to learn some more of the chilling details about this, it really starts to become somewhat eerie and also very, scary. So at this point, what we're aware of is that 10 to 15 minutes before he went to this Kroger, he tried to break into, as you mentioned just at the beginning of this segment, a predominantly African-American church in the Louisville suburbs, and he was unsuccessful in that. So I know the community is thinking of what could have been, that this could have been a terrible, even larger tragedy than it was as well. And so at this point, the thing that is being compared to is that this was considered to be racially motivated by the police officials in that suburban area because of a couple of things. One is looking back on Bush's criminal record, as it shows through court documents, and he had made racially charged statements in the past, and that has come up in certain domestic cases that he had been involved with. And also, a very eerie line that was said at the scene, according to a witness, was one shopper pulled out a weapon, and the two of them had it pointed at each other, and then Bush said to this customer, "Whites don't shoot whites," and then left. Which is a very chilling detail, and one that is being used to analyze the racial motivations of this case.
So, as I mentioned, one of the implications, the fallouts, the next steps, is that several members of the House of Representatives in Kentucky have pre-filed a bill to introduce the concept of hate crimes that could get attached to certain types of homicide. What difference would that make? We've got two very serious charges. We have multiple serious charges here around murder. What difference would it make if there was also a hate crime attached to that?
Of course. Well, I think that this bill comes as a reaction, or this the pre-filing of this bill comes as a reaction to how many people within the Louisville community here saw that, within hours of the shooting in Pittsburgh, it was declared to be a hate crime, and that it was being investigated as a hate crime. And officials here in Louisville, they were kind of dragging their feet in some regards, and part of that does have to do with the way that the state law is set up and defined. So at this point, according to Kentucky state law, a hate crime is deemed after sentencing by the judge, and it can affect your punishment and everything like that. But it mainly could affect things like probation or shock probation. And it's not necessarily even deemed as a crime, but it's deemed something after sentencing for whatever the original crime was. However, that distinction, like you mentioned, does not include crimes such as murder, manslaughter, reckless homicide, anything that's motivated by that. So because they wanted to speed this process up, and it seemed like it kind of just jumped over all of that. For example, if you committed if someone committed a murder and it appeared to be racially motivated, it couldn't be labeled as such right from the outset. And so I think they wanted to go back, and these two Republican lawmakers in the Louisville area have decided that this is what they want to add to it as well. So the difference that this would make was, instead of it being deemed after sentencing, right from the outset, you could speak very confidently about what charges were being pursued from the state level.
Would, if there was a, or additional charges as a result of hate crime legislation, would that impact the sentence in a way that's different than the way that can be taken into account now after the trial?
Sure. I believe at this point that these two Republican lawmakers, like, they're still working through those details, but yes, it would allow it to be deemed much more aggressively as an additional charge towards that. So again, like, for example, with those hate crime charges as it relates to the state law now, it's done after your sentence to your charges and everything like that. So it's kind of done as a post-mortem. So what it would do is, this would affect your sentence, like, before your sentencing, this could be factored in to the amount of prison time that you get.
Okay. The one other area that, as I read a number of your articles, was that the perpetrator, this Gregory Bush, looks like he has a history of mental illness, and there were concerns around his ability to access guns. Is that correct? And is that a factor, not necessarily on a hate crime side, but on another set of issues?
Sure. That is something that, I mean, so at thecourierjournal.com, we've just been completely hitting every angle of this as we can. This was a very jarring incident, a very public incident. And as we started to delve deeper into who Bush was, and this included an interaction of his social media accounts, this included his public court records and everything like that, we started to get more of a complete picture of who this man was. And what we found was very chilling. I mean, we saw on social media a lot of very racially motivated posts. I mean, for example, just the other day, we spoke with an attorney here in the Louisville area who was just interviewed by the FBI as they conduct their federal investigation into whether or not this was a hate crime, and told them about the interactions he had on Twitter with him. And one of those things, like you did mention, was his mental health. That was brought up in several cases where they deemed that he was not fit to have a firearm, but then that was obviously restored. So this is something that I would say, if we were weighing the two, his mental health and his access to guns was something that was brought up as a concern in the past and is certainly being looked at it as this. But I think prosecutors are very, very much so delving in to the racial motivations of the shooting as being paramount. And for example, even in the Louisville area, we have a very active political community, and we have Black Lives Matter Louisville. We have Showing Up for Racial Justice, and they are very much so kind of, and I guess the word is that they're very ingrained in trying to say that we should be looking at the racial motivations of the shooter, not so much the mental health aspect of this shooter. They want to be able to highlight and say, let's not make an excuse that this appears to be racially motivated in some sense. And while prosecutors are, like I said, looking at his access to guns and his mental health and everything like that, I believe at the forefront of all of this is, was this or was this not racially motivated in some sense?
Well, this is obviously going to play itself out over the next several months. And Thomas Novelli with the Louisville Courier-Journal, thank you very much for being here today and getting the discussion started in the greater Cincinnati area. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley. Over the past week, a leadership controversy between the CEO and the board chair of the United Way of Greater Cincinnati broke into the open. The result is that both the CEO, Michael Johnson, and the board chair, Julia Poston, have announced their departures. The local United Way, which is dependent on community confidence and support, must now figure out how to bring the current campaign to a conclusion as best it can and how to move forward for the long term. To discuss the forces at play, we are joined today by WCPO reporter Lucy May. If you would like to join our conversation, please call 513-419-7100 or email us at talk@wvxu.org. Lucy, welcome to Cincinnati Edition again.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
I want to recognize right at the beginning of this conversation, I have conflicts of interest in the sense that both Julia Poston and Tim Elsbrock are graduates of Leadership Cincinnati while I was running that program. Tim Elsbrock, in fact, was the chair of my board during the year that I was retiring and a new person was coming in to take over. And Julia Poston worked closely at the Freedom Center with us on several important initiatives. So I just want to lay that out so there isn't any question here. Lucy, this broke out in the open this past week, but how long do you detect that these issues have been, I don't know, bubbling up, for lack of a better term?
I think it's been bubbling up for a while. I mean, Michael Johnson, in the kind of what started this whole thing publicly, at least, was that Michael Johnson sent a lengthy email to all 60 members of United Way's board. The email was dated October 26th. It became public on October 29th, and he detailed his concerns, which, you know, have been pretty widely covered. But I obtained some previous emails. I know that on October 21st, so before he emailed the entire board, he had emailed select members of the board, including Julia Poston, outlining many, if not all, of those same concerns and suggesting kind of ways to move forward. In an October 21st email that we obtained, he said, you know, I'd still like to do this work. I feel confident that I can make this work, but here are some things that I need to make that happen. So at least it was at least earlier than he sent the email. He had kind of expressed his concerns, and surely, you know, it obviously that stuff doesn't happen overnight. I think it had been brewing for a little while. Of course, he's not been here that long. His first day was July 9th,
so 4 months.
Take long, or, yeah. Right? Yeah.
So, and how do those emails, you go back to October 21st? There was an announcement. I'm not sure the exact date of the projection that this year's campaign was going to fall as much as 20% short of its goal, and that there were going to have to be serious cuts to the money provided by United Way to various agencies. I found that a very surprising thing that had been issued so far ahead of the end of the campaign. Where does that fit in, that announcement of sort of warning the community that was happening?
Well, I think it's all related, because one of the concerns that Michael Johnson brought up, both in his October 21st email and the more public October 26th email, was a feeling that he had been misled about the local United Way's financial health. And he raises issues in both those emails saying, hey, you know, we haven't been collecting as much as I thought we had been. Of course, we haven't really been able to get the board's side of that. So I don't, you know, they haven't been able to say too much about what they feel like he did and didn't know when he took the job. But we sat down with Mike. Well, I talked to Michael Johnson and Ross Meyer and several other United Way leadership folks last week for a story that we did on that shortfall. And it was really, I have to say, the most transparent I've ever heard United Way be about its financial health. In the past, United Way has traditionally announced the total dollars pledged at the end of every campaign. But we, and I guess this is partly my fault as a reporter, I haven't pushed back on, well, how much of that did you collect? And they said it's pretty typical for there to be a gap in the amount that's collected versus the amount that's pledged, because they come through employee campaigns. If employee jobs get cut, or if you move, or if you leave to take another job, your donations don't typically follow you. So there's usually a gap. But in 2017, that gap was pretty big. I think they said it was about $3.5 million. And over the past 4 years, they estimate they're going to actually collect about $10 million less this year than they did 3 or 4 years ago. So it's a really big gap, and I think that you know, there's some tension surrounding that. Michael Johnson certainly expressed in at least a couple of emails that was a situation he did not completely know that he was wading into when he took the job. So I do think there's kind of a relationship there.
Well, you know, and I do, when we had Mr. Johnson on Cincinnati Edition, we started talking about the challenge of these campaigns, because United Ways all over the United States have been experiencing declines because the big corporations, there aren't as many of them, they're not employing as many people, they're not participating as much, and that's been the way that United Way has raised money. But with more and more people who operate as contractors and in the gig economy, you can't follow those people, you can't find those people. And there's been a fall off, and actually the Cincinnati United Way has sort of been the outlier in being able to continue to do fairly well. So I guess I was a little surprised that he expressed that he was surprised that there was a challenge here. And he said that on this show too. I was a little surprised by that.
Yeah. Well, and I think at least as I read his emails, part of his surprise was just the actual numbers here. I mean, I think in talking to him, at least he gave me the impression that he was aware of some of the fundraising challenges that United Ways faced. And one of the other things that, you know, is part of the mix is that there are all these apps now where that kind of get into companies and corporations give their employees the ability to donate money year-round to their favorite charities using these apps. And those kind of bypass United Way campaigns and community campaigns like United Way and ArtsWave. So yeah, there are a lot of factors that feed into that that are definitely affecting not only this United Way, but like you said, United Ways across the country.
And there was the other thing that was really talked about here was that Michael Johnson felt like he was being micromanaged by the board chair, by Julia Poston. And I don't know, maybe by other members of the board, and not sort of being allowed to carry out what he felt he knew he could do. How would you develop that view that he has of the situation he was in?
Well, the way he explained it was that there were a number of instances where he said that Julia Poston asked him to run things by United Way's chief strategy officer, who was actually one of his subordinates. So he questioned why the CEO would be told, you know, he had to run things by a subordinate. He was asked to run a lot of things by Julia Poston before he shared with other board members or other folks, which, according to his emails and that, was something that he didn't feel like was completely necessary. And I think, you know, he also talked in that October 26th email about feeling what he termed subtle threats from interactions with Julia Poston. Again, Julia Poston hasn't been at liberty to talk about her perspective on this a whole lot, so we really know more about Michael Johnson's perspective than anybody else's based on these emails. But it sounds like the relationship was not working on a lot of different levels.
You know, in what's happened now is that both Michael Johnson, as of yesterday or last night, announced that he was going to return to his former job with the Boys and Girls Club in Wisconsin. This morning, Julia Poston announced that she was leaving the board and the chair position of United Way. Where does the organization as an organization stand, especially given that Ross Meyer is now the interim CEO? And I can tell you, being an interim anything is an uncomfortable position. I've been there. And
yeah.
that's a difficult position to be in.
Yeah, it's a difficult position to be in, especially under these circumstances, because inside United Way, I think it's fair to say emotions are very raw. We did a story that published last night about a staff meeting that was held Thursday morning at United Way, where employees were kind of asked to, you know, share their pain and say what's on their mind. And they, you know, a number of employees, based on a recording of the meeting that we obtained, an audio recording, were very hurt. They felt betrayed. They asked, Julia Poston was at the meeting to kind of hear their concerns, and they asked her a number of times to resign. One man finally asked her to leave the room, which she did. So emotions are very, very raw inside the United Way. In fact, we got a letter last night signed by 30 of United Way's roughly 125 employees expressing their concern and dismay over the situation. In that letter, they demanded the removal of Julia Poston as board chair, and suggested that the executive committee of the board could resign too if they saw that to be proper. This morning, before an 8 a.m. United Way board meeting, about 21 United Way employees lined up on the sidewalk, on either side of the sidewalk, up to the entrance of United Way, and expressed their feelings to the board in person to make sure they knew, how the employees were feeling. It was all very, respectful and that sort of thing, but the employees wanted to make sure that the board knew where they were coming from. So there's a lot of hurt inside of United Way right now, and the big concern for everybody is how that's going to spill over to the rest of the community, because United Way funds more than 140 nonprofits in the region. Those nonprofits serve roughly 300,000 people every year. They're dealing with some of the biggest problems and issues our community faces, from childhood poverty and hunger and, all these different things that United Way agencies really work to alleviate across the region. So there's a real concern that, as this campaign winds down, it's supposed to be wrapped up on November 14th. This timing is just terrible, and, there's a question of how much this turmoil will spill over into other organizations that rely on the United Way and the people they serve.
And I think there is particularly a sense of, two things I'd like to raise here. One, coming out of that staff meeting, how much did the dynamic there of race play into that? Because that seems to be, as the reporting that gets out to the public on this, that was a major part of what was going on. Michael Johnson feeling that this white female was overseeing in a way that was improper. How much of that gets reflected in that staff meeting that you were able to hear?
A whole lot. And I really think we've had some talks about this within the newsroom. I think, and I have to confess that it's been a few days since I read that October 26th email, and there's been a lot of reporting between the time I read it and now. But I don't know that Michael Johnson in that email really explicitly raises the issue of discrimination and racism. But it's pretty clear to see between the lines, and a lot of community leaders have read the situation that way. And in listening to employees of United Way in this audio recording, they brought that up very candidly. And I don't want to go, in the story, I didn't go into a lot of specifics about that, but because this recording was made without most people's knowledge, I didn't feel like it was fair or responsible to quote people by name or even quote a lot of specific words that were in the meeting, but race was definitely a factor.
Lucy May from WCPO, I'd like to thank you for being here today and for your reporting on an issue and really an anchor institution in this community, which we do need going forward. We need to figure this out. Thank you very much. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer, Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstro. Archives of our program are available on the website, wvxu.org. I'm Dan Hurley.